Welcome to San Francisco City Insider, the San Francisco Chronicle podcast on the people in politics making headlines in the city by the bay. I'm Chronicle columnist Heather Knight, and I'm here today with Alex Kroll, one of the world's preeminent experts on safe consumption sites, where people who use drugs can legally shoot up or smoke inside under supervision. He's a fellow at RTI International, an independent nonprofit research institute dedicated to improving the human condition. And he's also a resident of Glen Park. Alex Kroll, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
We're here today to talk about safe injection sites. I know there's other terms that are also used, safer injection sites, safer consumption sites. Can you explain what those are and why they're a good idea?
Yeah, so safe consumption sites are essentially places where people can bring their pre-obtained drugs in to use them safely within the site while they're being monitored by somebody in case of overdose or other kinds of medical issues. Mm-hmm. I think that's the basics of them.
Yeah, it sounds very controversial when you first hear about it, and a lot of people assume it's a bad idea that you're basically saying it's fine to do these drugs. But what do you think is the benefit to society of having these?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of research. These have been existing since the mid-80s, mm-hmm. actually. They exist in 10 different countries in Europe, Canada, mm-hmm. and Australia. And the research is pretty clear that they benefit both the people who use them and the communities that they're in. Mm-hmm. In terms of the people who use them, they reduce the likelihood of overdose death. Mm-hmm. They reduce HIV and viral hepatitis transmission. And they facilitate getting people into drug treatment and mm-hmm. other kinds of health and social services. In terms of neighborhoods, they found that the neighborhoods where these are put into, they have reductions in crime. They have less public needles, less needles in the streets, mm-hmm. And less public injection. Mm-hmm. So they really seem to benefit both the community and the people who use them.
Mm-hmm. Has there been any look about whether they draw dealers to the block where they're located?
Yeah, there was a study up in Canada that looked at that, and it does not seem to bring dealers into the neighborhood in any kind of way.
Cool. And for a couple of years, San Francisco, as well as some other cities, including Philadelphia and New York, and I believe Seattle, have been kind of on the verge of opening one, but I don't think any American city has officially done so, right?
Well, there's no sanctioned sites.
Right.
I've been evaluating an unsanctioned site mm-hmm. somewhere in the United States. But yes, there's about 7 or 8 cities that have mayors who have publicly said they want to open these sites. Mm-hmm. And they're in various different stages of figuring out how to do that.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is holding these mayors back, or what do they need to figure out?
That's a complicated question. It's different in different cities. Mm-hmm. I think it looks like they're on the verge of opening one in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. Perhaps even as early as later this month.
Wow.
After they had a big legal, I'd say battle, I guess, mm-hmm. there against
and they had a win in the courts, right?
And they had to win the courts. Mm-hmm. And so I think they're about to open that up. They're pending one more judgment to see if they can open while there's an appeal. Mm-hmm. And so that's the main thing that's holding them back there, is waiting for that right mm-hmm. now. In other places, there's been some political opposition. Seattle essentially has been trying to open one for a long time. They are the only city that has made the decision that it would be on city property by city employees. My understanding of what's going on up in Seattle is it's been hard to figure out the best site for that specifically, where that would be, mm-hmm. such that it would be a site that would be good for both the community that needs to use it, but also the community around there.
Yeah. Last time I wrote about the issue here in San Francisco, which was a couple months ago, the mayor has a plan. She wants to open one in a mobile clinic outside a facility, maybe like Glide, or outside a nonprofit that already exists, but not in the building, so as not to put whatever building that is in legal jeopardy. But her administration is not going to open that until President Trump is out of office. And I was wondering what you think of that decision.
Yeah, that's the first I've heard of that. And of course, we don't know how long Trump will be in office. That could be one more year, or it could be five more years, or even, I guess, depending on how, who you pay attention to, I guess it could be more. But so that's news to me. I know that she has been a big proponent of opening these sites, and certainly was during the last election, and her the first election as well. I think that, you know, the concerns I imagine for her, but I don't really know, would be, you know, illegals and, you know, federal government come in and shut it down or something like that. But
she's worried about the people who work there getting arrested and jailed potentially, or assets being seized.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, you know, with Philadelphia potentially opening, first of all, having won that lawsuit there, and then potentially opening and maybe seeing how that goes. Maybe that might change her mind, depending if that goes well or not. I don't know.
Do you think it's a wise decision to hold off, or would you recommend, if you were her advisor, to just go for it and let the chips fall where they may?
That's a good question. So last year, and really the last couple of years, over 70,000 Americans have died of overdose. That's a lot of people dying of overdose. In the tens of millions of times that these sites have been used internationally, no one's ever died of an overdose in one of these sites.
Wow.
And so if you think about that juxtaposition of having all these deaths in the U.S. right now, and deaths are spiking in San Francisco over the last couple of years now because of the fentanyl epidemic. I think it's – we need to have these. You know, they are the only thing that we know that is proven to work in order to save people's lives if they're overdosing. And so I think you need to move ahead of them. This is why Philadelphia is doing that. And I think a lot of other cities as well. You know, whether she is wise for her not to do it or wait, you know, I think the big question for me there is, if from a legal standpoint, it isn't really any different than cannabis. In fact, you know, the city already has authorized, which is federally illegal, you know, cannabis dispensaries here. And in fact, places and the city has permits for places where people can actually buy cannabis and use it on site. And so they already have drug consumption sites that are permitted by the city. It's just a matter of what drug is it. Now, all the drugs we're talking about are illegal federally, so there's actually no difference between the cannabis that they're currently permitting being used and, say, heroin or methamphetamine or cocaine that's being, you know, that would potentially be more likely to be used at some of these sites. So in that sense, I'm not sure, you know, frankly, we actually need safe consumption sites where people are using those other drugs way more than we would need consumption sites where people are using cannabis.
Because it's not killing people.
Because it's not killing people. Exactly. So in some ways it's backwards in my mind.
Has the name of these changed to consumption because it's not just for injection drugs?
Yeah, so
all kinds of drugs are used in the foreign.
So depending, you know, some are safe injection sites because they just are about people injecting, but others, people are smoking. For example, they might be smoking crack cocaine, or they might be smoking fentanyl, even. And so, depending on the site,
Are there any that allow meth that you're aware of?
Sure,
yeah,
they all do.
They all do.
Yeah, they all do. It's not really. There's none that I know of, and there's about. You know, at this point, I think the latest count is about 160 of these programs around the world. None that I'm aware of specify the kinds of drugs that are allowed to be used. So you can use any drug you'd like to use.
Interesting.
But there's some that are set up for just for injection and some for smoking. The key about the smoking is you need to have ventilation. And so, you know, which can be expensive. It can be like one of those restaurant hoods or something like that, which are expensive to buy.
But you would think that would be valuable in San Francisco to allow both smoking and injecting.
Yeah, I definitely think so. You know, and I think especially with, you know, the advent the last few years of fentanyl, I think that's even more important because people are much more likely to smoke fentanyl than they are to inject it even. And so lots of people overdosing just smoking it. So we need to make sure that they are okay as well.
And as you alluded to earlier, you've been studying an unsanctioned safe injection site for a number of years. Right. How many years have you been looking at that?
5 years
five
now.
Years.
That's been functioning a little bit over 5 years.
Okay. And you've never disclosed where this is,
true,
right? But
true.
It's a city in America.
It's a somewhere in the United States, exactly.
A city?
Yes.
Okay. And you visited this place a number of times?
I have.
Yeah. And what are you finding there?
You know, it's been really successful in the sense that people are using it. They're happy to use it. Then they're coming there to mm-hmm. use it. There has been about 36 overdoses at the site.
Oh, wow.
All of them were saved by the professionals that are working mm-hmm. there.
No deaths.
Just like there have been no deaths at all the other 160 mm-hmm. sites around the world. And so in that sense, it's been really successful at saving people's lives right then and there. And it's also provided a sense of community for the people who are in there, mm-hmm. Such that they feel like there's a place they can go and talk to people and, you know, receive counseling and camaraderie mm-hmm. and talk about the kinds of concerns they might have in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Is it run by a nonprofit or who's actually operating it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And does the neighborhood around it know that it's there? Like how known is this place?
It's not known by the neighborhood around it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there may be some people that know around it. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's been interesting in my mind because it's been operating now for a little bit over 5 years, mm-hmm. 5 1/4 years. And obviously it's not, you know, it's not explicitly legal. It's not specifically they don't talk about it. They are closed about it. Yet the people don't know about it everywhere. And so it's been interesting because, mm-hmm. you know, there's at any given time, there's maybe 50, 60 or 70 people or maybe up to 80 people or so that are currently, you know, involved in using it. Mm-hmm. And yet the sort of message hasn't gotten out there. Or they haven't told people about it or journalists.
All the types of drugs that you mentioned before are used there?
They use, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And we keep track of the kinds of drugs they use there, yeah.
Do you know if the mayor of the city knows about it, of the city that it's in?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know that.
Yeah. And they're not being open about it because?
Well, they're afraid that the federal administration would come down on them, I think, yeah.
And when you go there, what does it look like and how do you perceive it in terms, like what if you could describe, you know, visually what you see?
Yeah, it's a pretty simple place. I mean, these aren't as extraordinary as they might seem. Mm-hmm. You basically have two rooms. You have one large room that's got comfortable seating for people to sit and be. Mm-hmm. And then you have a smaller room that is where injections happen. In that room, you have stainless steel benches and mirrors, and they get, for free, they get clean equipment to mm-hmm. make sure that, that's clean. And they have somebody who then collects some data with them, and then they are there to provide counseling or help and also monitor, make sure that they are okay. Mm-hmm. But it's really not any more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. It's just two rooms for people to be, and one of them they mm-hmm. like I said.
And have you looked at what has happened to the neighborhood around it? Like if there's more or less needles on the ground or open air drug dealing usage or dealing or anything like that?
Yeah, we're in the middle of doing some of that research mm-hmm. and we haven't gotten to, we're analyzing the data mm-hmm. right now and we haven't published that data yet, but okay. we are looking at that, yeah.
Okay. Does it look like it's going to be good news or bad news?
I can't tell you that yet.
Okay. I'm Heather Knight and I'll be right back after this. I'm back with Alex Kroll. You're also an expert in overdose prevention and education, and San Francisco continues to see scores of OD deaths every year. In addition to opening one of these sites, do you think that there's something else the city can be doing to prevent these?
That's a good question. I do think housing is a big issue mm-hmm. in general, and that hurts, overdoses as well. We do have more overdoses because, in part, because of the environments that people are in and mm-hmm. where they're using. If you're, one of the big pieces of the puzzle here is that if people are using outside, they're having to rush their shots. Basically, they're having mm-hmm. to hurry up their injections because they don't want people to see them, or mm-hmm. they want to be seen by people, whether that be, families or just people walking by or the police even. Mm-hmm. That's a particular problem with something like fentanyl, whereby you really want to, you know, in order to be using that more safely, you want to be able to test a shot and see whether it has fentanyl in it, or see how much there is, mm-hmm. and really, you know, use it slowly, mm-hmm. To not sort of just get the whole shot in one, because that's where a lot of the problems have come in terms of people overdosing. Mm-hmm. And so providing both these sites, but also places for people to live, is an important component to the overdose situation. Mm-hmm. Here. Other than that, there's a couple of other big things. One is fentanyl test strips, which I don't know if you've heard much about, but these are basically just a $1 little strip. It's almost like a pregnancy test almost, but it's almost a paper little strip. It's maybe 4 inches long or so. And it was developed for testing urine for people like doing drug testing. Let's say, mm-hmm. you have a company and you want to drug test your employees, mm-hmm. or something like that for urine. But people who use drugs, who almost always are the ones to figure out the best solutions for their own lives. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to acknowledge that. They figured out that you could actually touch the dope with these small test strips, and it would tell you whether there's fentanyl in them or not. Mm. That's really important, because if people need to know if there's fentanyl
where
or not.
Where do you get those?
The syringe exchange programs, mm-hmm. Hand those out. Mm-hmm. So that's a big thing happening here as well. And that's been happening around the country.
Mm. Are they handing that out in San Francisco?
They are handing that out in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they are handing it out in many different states. And this has been going on for a couple of years now. Mm-hmm. Again, the federal government has been hesitant on these. Federal administration that's involved with the substance abuse and mental health services. The head of that has been against these, hmm. because they basically think that it's a way of enabling people to use. But I think that, and we don't really have good research on, mm-hmm. them yet.
Would you mostly use them to test heroin specifically, or could it be other?
Actually, it could be other, because there have been, you know, there's a lot of people talking about how at times even stimulants like methamphetamine or cocaine have been contaminated with fentanyl. And, hmm. so people don't know that they have that in them as well. Mm-hmm. And so if you have one of these test strips, again, they're just $1. They're very cheap. Mm-hmm. You can test to make sure that you don't have fentanyl in there.
Some San Franciscans are confused by City Hall's policy of giving free needles to people who inject drugs without requiring that the dirty ones be returned. It used to be a one-for-one exchange, and now it's not. How would you explain to people who are confused by that why that's a good switch to have made?
That's an old, that's a sort of a blast from the past.
Yeah. A lot of people, I get emails about this all the time.
Yeah. So, I've been conducting research around injection drugs in San Francisco since 1993. It's, mm-hmm. been, 26, 27 years. Much of my early work was around syringe exchange programs. Mm-hmm. And together with my colleague, Ricky Bluthenthal, and I, we did a lot of work looking at what kinds of things work and don't work, not just do needle exchange programs work, because we do know that they work. They reduce HIV, hepatitis, mm-hmm. C, and help to facilitate people getting into other kinds of services. One of the things that we found was that we compared all the needle exchange programs in California at the time. This was in 2000 to 2002. At the time, there were 23 programs in the state. Mm-hmm. Now I think I think there's above 50 at this point. But at the time, and we compared the programs that were these one-for-one strict programs, mm-hmm. to the ones that actually gave a little bit more than that. Mm-hmm. And we found that the people who go to the programs that are one-for-one are more likely to reuse their syringes. Mm-hmm. And so that's a concern for HIV and hepatitis. Mm-hmm. And so one of the main points of syringe exchange programs is to reduce the transmission of HIV, mm-hmm. and viral hepatitis. And so if that's the goal, then I think we want to make sure, mm-hmm. that people are getting enough syringes, mm-hmm. Out there.
People think, whether accurately or not, that the giving unlimited needles out has contributed to us seeing so many needles left on the sidewalks. Do you see any link there or not?
That's a great question, too. Yeah, so we conducted a study in 2009 on exactly this particular issue, and we compared San Francisco, which at the time was had the same policy it has now. Mm-hmm. The policy you're talking about, one-for-one, was something that changed
a long time ago.
15
yeah,
years
right.
ago. Yeah, so it's a long time ago. And we compared it to, and so at the time, I think the city was giving out about 3.5 million syringes a year. Mm-hmm. So about, I don't know where they're up to now, but certainly not
it's
that.
It's more than that, I think.
Yeah, it might be up to 6 million or something like that. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't have those numbers precisely. But we compared it to a city that didn't have a needle exchange, which was Miami in Florida. Mm-hmm. And what we did was we randomized all the blocks in San Francisco, and we did a randomization of 1,000 blocks. And we did parks as well, did mm-hmm. half the parks, including Golden Gate Park. And then we did the exact same thing in Miami, mm-hmm. randomized 1,000 blocks, and then we walked them and looked for syringes. Hmm. So at that time, this is 2009, mm-hmm. We found 20 needles on those 1,000 blocks and in the parks in San Francisco. And in Miami, I think it was something like 500 needles. Mm-hmm. The rates were crazy different, mm-hmm. Much, much worse in a city that didn't have needle exchange mm-hmm. than one that did. Now, you might
Seems
say
like we started seeing a lot more needles
We're seeing
later
a lot more
that.
Needles
yeah.
now, right? So I'm not discounting that. So if we did that study now, there probably would be a lot more. Mm-hmm. But that tells you it's not really about needle exchange. It's mm-hmm. actually about the conditions of the city as mm-hmm. it is.
Yeah.
In 2009... you know, lots of people who were living at the margins in terms of housing were living in squats mm-hmm. in South of Market. Mm-hmm. They were living and using drugs inside in lots of places that were available. Mm-hmm. But since then, because the tech industry and a lot of other, much larger factors around gentrification, people don't have any of those kinds of informal places to use inside anymore. Mm-hmm. And so people are using drugs outside, and therefore, well, their needles are also outside.
Right.
So that's the reason we're seeing way more needles now than we used to. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with needle exchange or mm-hmm. whether there's a one-for-one policy or not.
Got it. You also look at the interplay between drug use and the criminal justice system. San Francisco has a new district attorney who seems very unlikely to charge people for using drugs and probably also not for dealing drugs. And I was wondering what you think of that and what San Francisco could do to prevent so much open-air drug use on our streets.
Yes, we do have a change here with, Chesa Bedin was, I think he was sworn in today, in
yes.
fact, right?
By the time this comes out, he will be officially the DA, but he hasn't been sworn in
okay,
as
so,
of right now.
Right. Drug use, I've never really understood why drug use is the purview of the criminal legal system mm-hmm. One way or the other. It's actually, if anything, it's a health problem or
right.
a social problem. And so that's a clunky at best. I mean, mm-hmm. that's a generous way of putting it, mm-hmm. Way to use the criminal legal mm-hmm. system, including jails and prisons for those sorts of things. That's not, I mean, we've been doing that for decades and decades. And we haven't seen any improvements based on that. There's certainly no research that shows that criminalizing drugs and criminalizing people who use drugs has somehow solved this this issue. Mm-hmm. We have more drugs now than
right.
we've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
We got more people using drugs now than we've ever had. Really, I think most of that's been it's really been just a racist policy mm-hmm. issue. Is to figure out ways to discriminate against people and mm-hmm. and find ways to put people who are of color mm-hmm. behind bars.
Mm. What about dealing? Does that belong in the criminal justice system or not?
That's a good question. That's a tougher question mm-hmm. for me, I think, to ask. But I think that we have this strange dichotomy between dealing and using.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, like, these are the same people
yeah.
for the most part. Again, we're talking about drug use, which is not really a criminal issue.
Mm-hmm.
It really is a social issue one way or the other.
Do you think the city has enough treatment and other types of social services? to address it?
No, it definitely does not. Mm-hmm. And I know we've had in San Francisco since 1997, we've had a treatment on demand kind of policy where people should be able to have treatment mm-hmm. on demand.
Isn't that kind of in name only?
But yeah, I don't think that's the way it really functions. There's a lot of barriers to that. Mm-hmm. But there have been a lot of successes recently with regards to that as well. You know, buprenorphine is a very good drug treatment, form of medically assisted treatment. And there have been a lot of barriers to getting that. It used to be sort of more middle-class people who had access to it. But the city has started really a pioneer in getting this out to people through needle exchange programs, for example, where doctors can come and prescribe and give buprenorphine to people to start them on treatment there mm-hmm. through their health teams, to the doctors that are actually going out, these hot teams with the vans that are also getting people started on this treatment. And we're really one of the first in the country to do something like that, mm-hmm. which is great. And so there are good things happening. And that's the kinds of – those are the kinds of structural solutions we need to this really complex problem. Mm-hmm. We need to – make sure people have access to it, mm-hmm. not just that it be free, but also that it's easy for them to access it and that we come to them rather than having them, come all the way up the hill to someplace up in Parnassus or, right. or wherever it might be.
Do drug outreach programs tend to work where people are actually – treatment workers might be actually walking out, around Soma or the Tenderloin and
yeah.
trying to convince people to accept help?
Yeah. And I've been around long enough now that I've seen the cycles of this. And, back in the 90s and even in the late 80s, we had way more outreach workers than we do now.
Like I never
way,
see them now.
Way, way more.
Yeah.
And in the late night, actually, I think it was around 2000, 2005, about around that time, the city started to defund that mm-hmm. and they weren't funding those anymore. Mm-hmm. And so there are some great programs, I think of note, certainly, and you mentioned GLIDE, mm-hmm. But there are other places as well that have these kinds of outreach. San Francisco Drug Users Union, for example, they do some good outreach as well. There's a lot of these programs, but there's just not enough.
Yeah.
And really, it's about making a human connection. That's mm-hmm. what everyone really needs, one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And so having people out in the streets, talking to people, addressing them, their needs at the time, at the place. Mm-hmm. And that could include something like buprenorphine, for example, mm-hmm. Starting that right then and there, as opposed to, get on a wait list, come tomorrow to mm-hmm. my office
yeah.
or whatever it is. Yeah, these outreach programs, we really do need to refund those.
Mm-hmm. And what is one thing you think the average San Franciscan doesn't understand or gets wrong when it comes to understanding our huge drug crisis?
I understand a lot of the frustrations that people have. They're seeing people injecting out and about. Mm-hmm. They're seeing needles, at BART stations mm-hmm. and places like that. Certainly, we've seen the media play a pretty large role in that. But they also see that themselves. Mm-hmm. And, I don't think – nobody wants that. Mm-hmm. I think that what people sometimes get wrong is they think that people are okay with this or that people prefer this or that people would rather do that. Mm-hmm. And that's just not true. If we had more drop-in centers, we had these safe consumption sites, we had places for people to live, mm-hmm. Then it would be back to what it was like 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. When we never used to see public injections. Mm-hmm. And like I said, we counted needles back in 2009. Mm-hmm. That's only a decade ago. Mm-hmm. And there weren't many then either. And mm-hmm. so we could really get back to that. Mm-hmm. It isn't the, drug use itself or the people using drugs haven't changed. Mm-hmm. It's the conditions that have changed for them that's made it this way.
That's interesting. Well, you've survived the serious questions and you agreed to answer some of the sillier questions in our lightning round. Where is your favorite place in San Francisco to get a burrito?
Okay. That's a good question right there. And a polarizing, I know, in the city.
Even more than
here I am, I'm talking about safe consumption sites, and that's a polarizing enough issue. But this might be even more polarizing, especially as I'm probably, you know what, I might actually go out of the Mission. I actually like Cornetta in Glen Park the most. Maybe in parts, I live close by there, but I also really like their food as well.
That's my favorite too. So
it's not
polarizing within this podcast studio.
Wow. Okay.
What was the last book you read?
Right now, I'm reading a book about by what's his name, Besevich, who is writing about the war in the Middle East and essentially American involvement in the Middle East, really starting with the Carter administration through now. So that's what I'm reading.
Timely.
It is quite timely.
What was your first concert?
My first concert.
You grew up in Sweden, so maybe this is different than what we've heard before.
Well, I grew up in Sweden, but I moved to the States when I was 12, and I wasn't really going on concerts
when you were like
that.
Five.
When I was five, not so much. My first sort of big concert, I think, was Dire Straits,
actually. Nice. Yeah. You study really intense and somewhat depressing subjects all day. What do you do to have fun in the city?
You know, I really like going to see music. Live music is one of the things I like the most. So that's probably the thing I do the most.
What's your favorite venue?
Favorite venue. You know, I really like Bottom of the Hill. It's a great venue.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah.
Lastly, what is something you always make sure to squeeze into your busy day?
Well, I'm on a little bit on a health kick, and so I'm walking a lot. And so I'm doing this whole thing where lots of people are doing with counting their steps.
How many are you going for every day?
About 10,000 steps. And so we're doing that early in the morning, have a dog. We walk a dog and walk him through to Glen Park and around. So that's the thing I'm trying to do every day is do enough walking.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It was fun to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you to Alex Krall for joining me today. Thanks to King Kaufman and Karen Creighton for producing this episode, and to you for listening. San Francisco City Insider is part of the San Francisco Chronicle podcast network. Audrey Cooper is the editor-in-chief. If you like this show, please subscribe and give us a quick review wherever you get your podcasts. Support San Francisco City Insider and a lot of great journalism with a print or digital subscription to the San Francisco Chronicle. Find out more at sfchronicle.com/subscribe.